Just like this morning, John Cates is a criminologist, civil liberties lawyer, and author with a law degree from Yale. He is the beloved grandfather to all in the world of Second Amendment academics. Don Kilmer, who took the first win on incorporation in the Ninth Circuit's Nordyke versus King, calls Don Cates Papa Smurf. Don's topic this afternoon is the falsity of the notion that the Second Amendment was a compromise. And you can check tab number 7. Thank you. Don, it's yours.
All right. First of all, as a piece of information on the criminology of firearms, you will see in my written material, that weren't in my forward materials earlier, in 2003, the Centers for Disease Control, which has endlessly lobbied for banning handguns and for severe restrictions on other guns, published its study on the what gun control has accomplished in the United States, and its the conclusion of that study was that gun control had had no effect in reducing crime, suicide, or accidents. However, given the editorial control, the conclusion was that that's because the studies, some hundreds of them, are all incompetently done. And that's why they don't show the benefits of gun control. In 2004, the National Academy of Sciences did its own work for the same purpose and concluded, without the editorial revision, that they could not identify any gun control which had reduced suicide, crime, or gun accidents. Although I guess a completely successful ban on guns would necessarily reduce accidents. All right. Also, a very important point neglected earlier, neglected even in the massive tome that Alice Marie has produced. This is a photo of Alice's cat, whose name is Mago, and it was named, well, he is in fact the first cat since at least 146 BC and probably 202 BC to be named after Mago Barca, Hannibal's youngest brother.
At your request.
Yeah. Yes, it is certainly true that it was at my request. But he was a very able general, and he's a very able cat. All right. Key to understanding the Bill of Rights is to eschew the fiction that it was some kind of a compromise between the opposing political parties. The fact is that nobody gave a crap. Nobody. The author, James Madison, frankly said that this thing is unimportant, and the only reason I'm proposing it is because I committed, during the Virginia debate on the Constitution, I committed the Federalists to producing a Bill of Rights. The anti-Federalists, who were supposedly the people who think, the people who say, I don't know anybody thinks, that this was a compromise don't know that the Anti-Federalists opposed the Bill of Rights. It is true that during the Constitutional Convention debate, as a make-weight, they said, well, there's no Bill of Rights attached to this, so you should not ratify it. The reason for that is simple. They didn't give a shit about the Bill of Rights. What they wanted was for the Constitutional Convention provision to be defeated because they'd made a terrible mistake. They assumed that, like the Baltimore Convention, nothing was going to happen out of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And as a result, if you look at the list of delegates, the Anti-Federalists, or the people who became the Anti-Federalists, didn't come to the Constitutional Convention, and the Constitutional Convention is like, well, it essentially represented the view of one set of people in the same way that if Congress consisted of only Republicans or only Democrats, it would represent the view of one political party. And it was only because the Anti-Federalists had started off behind the eight ball that they ever came up with the idea of adding to the Constitution a Bill of Rights. Now, this was not just a political make-weight and an error they're not coming to the Constitutional Convention was their error. The political make-weight was also a problem because it turned out that the great majority of the American people did not buy their arguments about anything except having a Bill of Rights. Constitutions, which had been created for various states since the American Revolution, many of them had Bills of Rights, and apparently lots of ordinary Americans liked that. And while they didn't buy the Anti-Federalists, what the Anti-Federalists were really concerned with was various provisions of the Constitution they didn't like. They wanted something else than those provisions. So that's the argument they tried to make, and it didn't sell. What sold was their argument that they didn't care about, their phony argument for a Bill of Rights. And they found it ended up that they had endorsed a Bill of Rights and they were going to get a Bill of Rights even though they didn't care about it. Furthermore, the Bill of Rights was drafted by James Madison, who was not only an arch Federalist, but among the people in the Constitutional Convention who were most hostile to states' rights. Madison's had two major proposals on states' rights. And those proposals were, number one, that instead of a Senate that represented each state, there would be a bicameral legislature, but it would be elected just as the House was elected on population. Well, of course, he lost on that. And the other thing he wanted was no state could pass any law without that specific law being approved by the federal government. He lost on that. And he considered the Constitutional Convention a failure because of those two losses. Or at least so he said. All right. So clearly it is not the case that Madison wrote the Bill of Rights as a compromise with the Anti-Federalists over various things with which they were concerned. In fact, the Bill of Rights was it was mom and apple pie. It was a bunch of things that everybody agreed with, and nobody was opposed to. The Anti-Federalists were opposed to it because it was a Federalist proposal. The Federalists, it was just a big yawn to them. I mean, the important things were real issues, vital issues, like tonnage duties. Now, that was what they were greatly concerned about, and Madison had to constantly cajole the other legislators in the first Congress to get them even to consider his Bill of Rights. And what they did to his Bill of Rights was they took it and, making almost no important changes, they cut its wordage by about maybe 20%. Again, it was just what he had proposed, but with the wordage cut. Excuse me. And it is also important to note in regard to the Second Amendment that everybody approved of the Second Amendment, the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. There was an Anti-Federalist proposal authored by Sam Adams, and that read something like, the Constitution shall never be construed to prevent a man from keeping arms. The Anti-Federalists also had, eventually they decided they weren't going to be able to stop the Bill of Rights, and not that they cared that much about it, but they made their own proposals for the Bill of Rights. Proposals when Madison committed himself to writing a Bill of Rights, the one thing that was absolutely sure about that Bill of Rights was it wouldn't contain anything that the Anti-Federalists cared about. It would contain mom and pop things like the right to arms and habeas corpus. Well, no, I'm sorry. Habeas corpus was in the original Constitution. But the right to arms and the right to jury trial and all that, nobody gave a crap. They didn't, not because they didn't think this was a matter of importance in principle, but because they never conceived that the federal government would abolish any of these things. One thing that should be understood, Madison, in introducing the Bill of Rights in Congress, we have not his original speech, but we have notes on his speech And what he told the Congress was, this isn't necessary, it isn't important, and it doesn't do anything to change anything that's in the original Constitution. These are unnecessary provisions, which I've committed myself to proposing. And here they are. And basically, nobody disagreed with them or proposed, you know. The only disagreement was that the Anti-Federalists then proposed various other provisions. And those other provisions, which had to do with what the Anti-Federalists cared about, were not adopted. And indeed, some of Madison's, what we call the First Amendment, was actually the Third Amendment. There were two preceding provisions, which I don't, you know, so unimportant are they that I don't remember what they were. But as he proposed it, there would have been, I believe, 12 amendments rather than 10, and Congress scrapped two of them and cut them down to 10. The one thing that might have been of some importance that they did was on the issue of incorporation. As Madison had written the Bill of Rights, it applied against the states as well as against the federal government. And indeed, this is not clear. I mean, what Congress did was strike out the part that made it apply against the states. But even so, various state courts early in the history of the Republic held that the Constitution, the constitutional provisions governed over their state legislatures, which eventually Justice Marshall got rid of. Barron versus Baltimore, Permoli versus First Municipality of New Orleans, are the two cases, two early cases, one from 1807 and one from 1835. Well, no reason to go into all that crap. Anyway, there's just no basis at all for the notion that the Bill of Rights was a compromise with the Anti-Federalists. Now, it's important to understand what Madison thought he was saying when he was saying these things don't, my proposals don't affect any provision of the Constitution that applies to that would restrain state governments. What he was saying, or I'm sorry, not what restrain, that would restrain the federal government. Madison believed that our Constitution was like what the Canadian Constitution now has, or did have, when I was young enough to go to law school. That is to say, unless the Constitution contained a provision saying Congress may do X, Congress couldn't do X. And when the Anti-Federalists tried to argue against the Constitution, saying the new federal government will, if you pass this Constitution, will be able to do A, B, C, D, E, F, The Federalist response always was, no, it won't. The people cannot be disarmed because the Constitution doesn't say anything about arms. And if the Constitution doesn't say the federal government can do it, it can't. And the same argument as to freedom of religion. Constitution doesn't say anything about religion. Not covered. The federal government doesn't cover it. Madison did not anticipate that some years later, Chief Justice Marshall would misconstrue the Constitution to be a list of objectives with Congress having any power necessary to reach those objectives. That simply was not within Madison's view. All he did with the Bill of Rights, and in fact, again, he made this clear, all he did with the Bill of Rights was, and he said this, this doesn't affect anything of any importance. This is, I have carefully, in the Bill of Rights, In this Bill of Rights, I have carefully covered only things that we all agree with. There are no disputed points in this Bill of Rights. All right. Let me see if I can stumble through the rest of this speech. All right, let me quote Madison. No power can be exercised but what is expressly given. So, again, the Constitution, in Madison's view, was a set of express provisions for what Congress could do. And if it didn't expressly say what Congress could do, Congress couldn't do it, couldn't deal in any way with it. And in fact, when the anti-federalists argued that the federal government could become tyrannical, the anti-federalists the federalist response to that was, the people are armed. The people, you know, you can't tyrannize over the people because the people are armed and they won't permit it. Now, let me see if I've got something else in here. Otherwise, I'll finish up and all right. Leonard Levy, the historian of the Constitution, in discussing the Bill of Rights, noted that Madison was not just the father of the Constitution, as he had been called, but the father of the Bill of Rights, because only because of his earnest attempts did Congress momentarily stop looking at important questions like tonnage duties and look at this unimportant, basically irrelevant thing. All right, anybody got any questions? Yep.
Minor correction. There were 12 amendments set out by Congress for the states for ratification. The first two were not ratified at the time, but one of them, the one about Congress giving itself raises, was actually finally ratified in the 1990s. Obscure thing, a undergraduate at the University of Texas noticed that this thing was still out waiting for ratification and had no time limit on it, and wrote a law review article on it, I believe, and got a number of states to go ahead and ratify it. What you were mentioning about the lack of interest by Federalists in getting this thing passed, there's a marvelous letter by Congressman Fisher Ames, written the day after Madison wrote gave a speech introducing the Bill of Rights, in which he says, you know, Representative Madison has introduced his list of Bill of Rights, and he lists a whole bunch of them, and then at the end he says, I almost forgot, a right of the people to keep and bear arms. And then in Latin he writes, friends, withhold your laughter. Because he thought it was just a silly little thing Madison was doing to make himself popular. And it really does reflect the view of a lot of the people in that first Congress. We got important stuff to do here.
Yeah, exactly. All right. No further questions appearing. I shall again.
Don, now it's Dave's turn to beat him up.
I'm sorry?
Now it's Dave's turn to beat him up.
I found it interesting that you have to think of Bill of Rights as a federalist written proposal, so it was meant to keep the anti-federalists happy or at least off their backs. And what was that one article that included the title Throwing the Tub to the Whale or something like that, that tried to argue the Second Amendment and by inference the Bill of Rights was meaningless, stemming from the urban legend or nautical legend, whatever you call it, that if a boat was attacked by a whale, and why a whale would attack a boat unless someone had stuck a spear in its back was not entirely clear. But in case the whale did attack your boat, you could throw a tub over the side and that would act as a decoy, which makes about as much sense as assuming a whale is going to attack your boat. I trust any whale that wants to attack boats can tell the difference between a washing tub and a boat. Anyway, his thing was that one of the framers, or one of the framing generation, had written that the Bill of Rights was a tub to the whale. And he tries to construe that as the Bill of Rights, or at least the Second Amendment, is largely intended as a decoy, is unimportant. But actually, I think viewed in context, what you have is it's a decoy if you're a federalist in 1789. Because you want to set up a strong central government, strong by the standards of those times. Do you want to establish a church? No. Do you want to disarm the people? That would be suicidal. Do you want to repress freedom of speech? Well, a few years down the road, but just not now. And so, if we're not going to do any of those things, why don't we get our critics off our backs by saying we can't do those things? Myth was a tub to the whale because we never intended to go there anyway.
All right, we over now?
Okay, thank you.